Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Everything is meaningless. There is no point to life whatsoever. We observed last week that the preacher looked at his life, tried by reason and a systematic approach to discover whether there was any way that life could be seen as being meaningful. And he concluded that meaning cannot be found in the pursuit of wisdom and knowledge. That doesn't bring meaning to life. Meaning cannot be found in the pursuit of pleasure. That still leaves life ultimately meaningless. Hard work, that again will not bring a sense of meaning and purpose to life. Nor will striving after greatness and being the best. In the end, the preacher concluded, life is futile. There's no way that life can be made to appear meaningful. That we can never find true, lasting, ultimate satisfaction in life. It's vain. It's empty. It's meaningless. And now in the passage that's before us, from verse 16 of chapter 3 through to the end of chapter 5, he proceeds to examine whether perhaps, though there's no meaning to life, no ultimate satisfaction to be found in life, can life be improved? Can we make life something better for ourselves than it appears on the surface? Can we get some satisfaction, some fulfillment out of our vain lives after all? And there are seven areas that he examines to see whether this is a possibility. In verses 16 to 22 of chapter 3, he examines justice. Can we find more meaning and improvement in our lives through finding justice? And he concludes that it's futile. Futile to hope for justice in this world. He says, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. He says, I looked at life and life seems so futile, it seems so empty. But there must be some kind of justice available to us in life. There must be some way of saying, well, at least, you know, life is an honourable existence. But he says, no, I couldn't even find that. I went to the place where you would expect to find justice, at the seat of judgment. He went to the law court. He said, if anywhere we can find some kind of justice, some reason, then that must be there. And he says, but when I went there, in the place of judgment, there was wickedness. In the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. Even at the seat of judgment, there wasn't any truth really to be found. I imagine that the same sort of arguments went on then as they do today. What's the whole point of our justice system? If you're a lawyer, if you're a prosecuting lawyer, the whole point of your existence is to win the argument and get your prosecution. If you're the defense lawyer, the whole point of your existence is to get your client off. It doesn't actually matter whether the person's guilty or innocent. Your job is to do your job, prosecute or defend. And there are actually certain restrictions on the legal system in the Western world that if you find that your client is guilty, when you're trying to defend him of his charges, you can't actually say that. You're not allowed to let justice have its way. You can decide not to handle the case. But you can't stand in the court and say, well, actually I was appointed to defend my client, but all the evidence I've seen points against him. This man's guilty. Justice must be served. Oh, that's not what the point of the law courts is, it would seem. Not to find justice. Wickedness is there. Iniquity is there. You think of the case of the man this week who, after spending some years in prison, has been found to have been innocent of the crime. DNA tests proved that he could not have raped the girl that he was said to have raped. Family commented on this. Well, the perpetrator of this crime is still out there then. Not a word of sorrow for the fact that this man has spent time in prison for a crime he hadn't committed. The family wants closure. This man went to prison and for a while they had closure. And now their lives have been spoiled again. Not a thought for the fact that this man's life has been spoiled, probably irreparably. You never hear that, do you? Or very rarely do you hear when someone is convicted of a horrendous crime, well, I hope we've caught the right person. I hope justice has really been served here. You rarely hear that. The only time I can think of since coming to New Zealand where I've heard that was actually in the case of Ben Smart and Olivia Hope. After the man was convicted of that crime, Olivia Hope's father actually said, well, I hope that justice has been served here. I hope we have caught the right person. Because that's what justice is about, isn't it? Convicting the guilty, not winning an argument. And the preacher says, well, I looked at the justice system and I found even there it was wanting. And so it's no wonder then that in our everyday lives we feel that injustice prevails. In our lives from day to day, when things go against us, when we're accused of doing things that we never did, well, it's not surprising, is it, that these things happen? And then the preacher says, well, I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wickedness. In the end, there will be justice. He's quoting what he knows to be true from his theology. He's an Israelite. He's a worshipper of the living God. He's been taught by the scribes. He knows what his duties are, and he knows this truth. God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. There is a time there for every purpose and for every work. It will. Justice will prevail. That's his immediate response. And then he pauses and he thinks, I said in my heart, concerning the condition of the sons of men, God tests them that they may see that they themselves are like animals. He pauses and he says, well, is this right? I know, I've been taught, justice will prevail ultimately. If not in this life, then in the next life. But he says, how do we know? What do we know about life? I'm born, I live, I die. My flesh rots, returns to the earth from where it came. But that happens to the animals as well. What happens to the sons of men also happens to the animals. One thing befalls them all. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over animals. He is vanity as well. He is meaninglessness as well. All go to one place. All are from the dust. All return to the dust. Who knows, he says. Who knows whether, and this is a slightly better translation than what we have in the New King James, if this is what you're using. Who knows whether the spirit of the sons of men goes upwards and whether the spirit of the animal goes downwards? He's saying, who knows whether ultimately we go to different destinations? Who knows whether after death there's any difference between animals and man? Who can say that there's any difference whatsoever between us? We die the same way, we rot and become dust once again. And who can say? There's no proof that there's an afterlife. And therefore there's no definite hope of justice in the world to come when there isn't justice in this world. Who can tell what's going to happen when I die? And all the injustices that I felt, will they be put to right? Well, there's nothing definite to be said about it. As far as we can see, as far as we're able to perceive, animals and mankind, their destiny is the same: to die and be buried. You see, this is the perspective of this man. We mustn't get the wrong idea from the fact that some English Bibles translate and use the word preacher. This man isn't a preacher in the sense that we think of a preacher of God's truth. That word can also be translated as teacher, just someone who passes on information to others, guides others, teaches others. This man has no certainty about the future. His view of life is as long as there is life, but once death comes, that's it. It's all over. That's the end. There's nothing more. And this is affecting all of his reasoning. Throughout this book, he can't see beyond this life to a life to come because he has no certainty that there is such a thing. How can we find meaning and purpose in life? Well, the only way we can do it is to look beyond this life. If we have an earthbound view, as the preacher in Ecclesiastes has, then life is vain. Life is meaningless. We go through all kinds of trouble and toil and torment and injustice, and in the end we die. And that's it. It's only when we can see beyond the grave to another life. It's only when we recognise that the breath that man has is different from the breath that an animal has. And I'm not talking about the gases that we breathe in that enable our bodies to function. I'm not talking about that, but if the writer of Ecclesiastes or the preacher in Ecclesiastes had remembered back to the creation account, he would have remembered that God breathed into the man the breath of life. And it's expressed in a very distinct and different way. There's something different here. Man is made in the image of God. Man is given a soul. Man is different from the animal. And yes, they both die in a similar way. But we can have the assurance that the spirit of man does go back to God. The preacher uses that language later on, and we'll see that he uses that language as well, the spirit returning to God. But he has no certainty that that is actually an ongoing life. The existence has come to an end. But we see beyond that. It's only there that we can find meaning in life. To see that yes, God gives us a soul that will last forever. It has a beginning, it has a starting point. But it is an eternal soul. And how we live for God in this life will determine what happens to that soul upon our death. Will it received justice from God, and all the evil that is done against us be put to right? This is what the man wants to know, and he says he can't know. There's no way of knowing. But we know that God is a just God. God is a righteous God. And God will judge the righteous and the wicked on that day. The question is, are we ready for that day? This man clearly isn't. He's not prepared. Doesn't even know for sure that that day is coming. But we know. Are we ready to stand before God to be judged? He will judge the righteous and the wicked. What will our claim be then? How will we stand before God then? Will we be able to say, look, Lord, I've lived my life well. I deserve to be blessed by you. Is that what we're going to be able to say to God? Or are we the perpetrators of injustice as well as the recipients of it? Because ultimately, justice has to do with God. And his creatures' response to him, not to one another as such. That comes into it. But ultimately, our sins towards one another, our injustices towards one another, reflect on our attitude towards God. Are we ready to stand before God and to claim that we're right before him? What will be our plea on that day? Well, those of us who are Christians, we know that our plea is not in ourselves, not in our goodness, not in our ability to avoid being unjust. But our hope is based on Jesus Christ, who has paid the price for our sins, who has taken our iniquities upon himself and clothed us with his righteousness. And so we look to death with hope. We will be freed from the sin that so easily besets us. And we will be made perfect on that day. And we will be able to stand before God with boldness, clothed in the righteousness of Jesus Christ, and looking forward to a perfect heaven, a perfect earth, in which we can dwell with security. So this man, he says, well, you can't improve life by seeking justice. This world is full of injustice, and ultimately there's no certainty that justice will ever prevail. So he moves on and he says, well, what about all the oppression that there is in the world? It's a type of injustice, I suppose, but his thoughts have moved on. He says, I turned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there is power, but they, that is, the oppressed, have no comforter. Therefore I praise the dead who are already dead, more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed. He was saying before, we're no better than animals. Now he's saying, it would have been better if we'd never been born. Life is full of oppression. Whether we are the ones who are being oppressed or whether we're observing it. We can't get away from this fact. Throughout our lives, we're bombarded with this reality that people are oppressed. And there seems no way to relieve them of their suffering. You see the news, and virtually every day there's something on the news that gives evidence to the fact that there are people around the world who are severely oppressed, even though we ourselves may not be. And we look at it and we say, well, we're so weak, we're so helpless, we can't do anything about this. And this man says, well, yes, this is true, and it was better then that no one was born. Better not to be born in the first place than to have to deal with the oppression that there is in the world, to look on helplessly as those people are oppressed, or to be helpless under oppression. We can't improve this world in which we live. It's so marred, so spoiled, so vain and futile, the life that we live here. But is that the way that we're to look at it? The reality is there. This man isn't lying, is he? He's talking about what he observes in life, and the world hasn't changed in 2,500, 3,000 years. Still a world full of oppression. And we at times find ourselves oppressed. How do we respond to that? Can we say, well, actually, even in the midst of oppression, there's meaning? Well, we have to look to Jesus Christ again, don't we? To find meaning in the midst of oppression. We look to God once again and we recognize that this is God's justice being worked out in this world. It's as a result of the fall of man that oppression has come. And it's to remind us of our sin and to point us to God to seek mercy from Him. But more than that, for the Christian, it reminds us of Jesus Christ, who, though he was perfect, was oppressed beyond all that we could imagine. He suffered and he died for sins that were not his own. We all, as those oppressed or as those who observe oppression, recognize that we live in a world that is marred by sin. And that these are the just deserts for sin in the world. But Jesus Christ suffered for nothing that he had done. He was perfect. He was sinless. And we, in the midst of our suffering, are to look to Christ and to endure our suffering for his sake, even to glory in our suffering, as the Apostle Paul tells us, because it somehow fills up a sense of meaning for us in being partakers in the sufferings of Jesus Christ. Not that we are contributing to our salvation in any way, but it helps us to appreciate more and more what Jesus Christ has done for us as we suffer oppression and injustice. So even in the middle of that, the person who has an eternal perspective on life sees something more than the person who just has an earthbound view. For the person with an earthbound view, oppression is a severe evil because it spoils the very little that you can get out of life. But for the person who has an eternal perspective, this life is like a mist, like a vapor, soon gone. And while the oppression may seem severe while we're in the midst of it, it will soon be past. But it will help us to appreciate for all eternity the great oppression that Jesus suffered to redeem us from our sins. So we can find fulfillment even there, where the earthbound person sees only futility. He says also that it's futile to seek contentment in verses 4 to 6. Again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbour. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Then he quotes a parable. The fool holds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Better a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. What's he saying here? Well, a couple of things. First of all, he notes that when we work hard and when we achieve, we're envied for it. But then there's another side to that. We tend to envy other people as well. What he's saying is that our lives are motivated by a desire to keep up with or be one step ahead of the Joneses. That's where we are. We want to achieve as much, if not more, than our neighbour. We want to be as comfortably off, if not better off, than our neighbour. This is what motivates us. And he says, as a reaction to this, there are two extremes that need to be avoided. The one is to fold our hands and sit back idly, because then we just consume our own flesh. Everything goes. Don't get anywhere when you do that. But then there's the other extreme, having both hands full, but filled with toil filled with labor. Long hours, day after day, 7 days a week, to keep ahead of the Joneses. Better, he says, to have a hand full with quietness. Better to have only a part, but enough to be comfortable. But the whole thrust of this is that while that is the best, it's virtually an impossible attainment because we are motivated by envy, by greed, by covetousness. This is what keeps us going. And getting that balance, we know we shouldn't just sit idly by. We're going to consume ourselves. We're going to waste away, is what he's saying, if we act like this fool here. We know we can't do that. We know we shouldn't be so overpowered by this desire to be better than the Joneses that life becomes a vain grasping for the wind. But avoiding each of those extremes is next to impossible. Once we go down the road of wanting to be comfortable, we're never satisfied. We never are satisfied with the handful and quietness. We always want more. So even though we may know what's good, what's the best, we never feel that we've actually got there. And so futility reigns once again. And then he continues with the progression of this thought and says that it's futile also to pursue gain for oneself. I turned and I saw vanity under the sun. Here's an example, he says, of the vanity I saw under the sun. There is one alone. He's without a companion. He's by himself. Not only does he not have a friend, a companion, he has neither son nor brother. So everything that he acquires, he's got no one to give it to. No close relation to give it to. No next of kin who will take up where he left off. Yet there is no end to all his labours, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? For whom am I striving to fill both hands? Why am I not content with the little that I need to keep myself in food and clothing? And then the writer goes on and he says, this is the way we ought to view it. You see, going striving by ourselves for selfish gain isn't the way forward. Two are better than one. Throughout life, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labour. Then he gives an example, three pictures from a journey. These people are travelling, a friend, his companion. If they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him. Now this isn't just a trip over a rut in the road. This is a fall. He's fallen down a well. Remember how Joseph's brothers put him in the well? He couldn't climb out again. Woe to the man who's alone when he falls down a well, falls over a precipice. He's got no one there to help him. But the one who has a companion, there is help. Then again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how could one be warm alone? Here they are, they're on a journey. They've made slow progress. They've not made it to the inn at night. They've had to make do by the side of the road. And they huddle up together for warmth. But the man who's alone, he's got no companion to help him keep warm through the cold night. Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. Here's the picture of the parable, isn't it? Good Samaritan. There was the Jew walking along on his way to Jerusalem from Jericho. And he's overpowered by bandits. Well, he says, the writer of Ecclesiastes says, that though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. Where there's two, where there's more than one, there's a chance of defense. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Two's good, two's better than one, three's even better. But you see, the person who's motivated by wanting to be ahead, wanting to achieve, wanting to get more, he's going to be quite ready to leave his companions. Where they've become satisfied with what they have, he strives for more, he leaves them behind. They're not willing to go on with him, so he goes alone. So even though we know what's good, even though we know what's best, we keep striving, we keep pursuing, we're not satisfied, we want more than others maybe want to pursue for. And so, even there's futility. We know what's good, we know what's right, we know what's best, but this covetousness, this desire for gain, this desire to be a step ahead of everyone else, overpowers us. And then he goes on and he says, well, you know, there's another danger. There's the danger of striving alone. But then there's also the danger of feeding off popularity. The other extreme. And he uses an illustration of someone, of a king. He talks about an old foolish king. He's lived his life, he's had his reign, he's come to the end of his reign, and someone takes his place as king. It's someone who was poor. A youth who's come out of prison to be king. He was born poor and he rises to this exalted position. And there were many followers for this person. I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. They were popular. He was popular. He had this huge following. But then he goes on and says, but there comes an end to that. He was popular for a while, but those who came afterwards would not rejoice in him. When another king arises, this man's forgotten. Popularity is fading. Popularity passes away. Popularity is never going to give you fulfillment in life. Just a selfish gain never will. There's a balance that has to be forged here. But because of our selfishness, we never can get it. We never seem to strike that balance. We go off one way or the other in our pursuit of fulfillment in life. How does the Christian perceive these things? How are we to look at these things? Well, we're to remember words like those which Paul wrote to the Philippians. Chapter 4 and verse 12. I've learned to be content in whatever situation. When I've had much, when I've abounded, I've been content then. So much more to utilize for the ministry. In serving others, in helping those who are suffering oppression. I've had the abundance to be able to do that. Wonderful opportunities for service. And when I've been poor, when I've lacked food and clothing and shelter, then I've also been content. Content in the knowledge that the most important thing can never be taken from me. My God and his care for me. And my ultimate certainty that one day I will be with him in paradise and there will be never again any lack of things needful. This man here in Ecclesiastes has no hope like that. He looks at life and he says, it's impossible to be content in life. It's impossible. I know there's a better way. I know there's a way between these two extremes that can bring an element of satisfaction and contentment, but it's just impossible to strike it. It's such a narrow, such a tiny little target to aim at that it's impossible to hit it. But the Christian knows that our contentment is not found in what we have. Our discontent is not found in what we do not have. Our contentment is found in Jesus Christ. If we have any discontentment at all, it's in the frustration of not being able to serve him better. In grieving him day by day through our foolishness. But we know even there, even in that, that God is a loving God. He delights to forgive those who turn to him in repentance. And so we can find fulfillment in life and contentment in life. We don't have to join the rat race. We don't have to keep up with the Joneses. When God prospers us, we gratefully use that in his service. When we seem to have things withheld from us, then we look to God and pray to God and know that He will care for us in the midst of that. And perhaps thinking that that might be the case here, the preacher in Ecclesiastes warns about being overzealous for God, courting God's favour. He says it's futile even to court God's favour. He says, walk prudently when you go to the house of God. Draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of bulls, for they do not know that they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven, and you are on earth, therefore let your words be few. He's quoting things that we'll find in other books of the Bible as well. Lots of good thoughts here in this section, from verse 1 to verse 7 of chapter 5. It's not so much what he says, it's more the attitude with which he says these things that there's a problem. When you look at it, when you take it out of context, you can interpret this passage in a wonderfully positive way. But when you see it in context, looking at the verses before and the verses afterwards, understanding what you know about this man's attitude towards God and life and death, what he's actually saying here is that, you know, religious zeal is actually likely to lead you into more trouble than it's worth. You try and please God, but ultimately you're going to go too far. You're going to make a promise you can't keep. And you know, this God, he doesn't suffer fools gladly. He'll come down on you like a ton of bricks. You know, this is the God who's at a distance. He's in heaven, you're on earth, and here you are, you're pestering him with your zeal. It'll last for a while, but then you'll step over the mark and he'll lose patience with you. And he'll judge you. He'll punish you. And then it would have been better for you not to have done these things, not to have made your vow, not to have spoken those words, not to have tried to prove your zeal for God. Because in the end, it's going to backfire and it's going to do you more harm than good. That's the thrust of what he's saying here when we see it in context. But of course, we see the wisdom in these words that he's quoting from the Proverbs and elsewhere. We need to be zealous for God, but at the same time we need to avoid making promises we can't keep. Saying to God, if you bless me, I'll do this. And God blesses you and you can't do that. Hear about those sorts of things all the time. These are warnings certainly against that. But God must be the centre of our lives if we're to have any meaning at all in our lives. He must be there at the centre. We must have great zeal for him. We must make our bodies living sacrifices. In other words, we're to serve him with our whole being. We can't go too far in that. So this man, he says, it's futile to court God's favour, because in the end you'll step over the mark and you'll bring his judgment upon you. And then finally, in verses 18 through 17, he sort of sums up, draws in a number of the threads of thought that he's been thinking as he goes through here. And we're running out of time, so I'll just very quickly comment on this section. Basically, he says it's futile to attempt to make your life better. Life is meaningless, was what we looked at last week. That you can't find meaning in life. Now, life can't be made any better. It's pointless striving to improve. What's the in phrase these days? Being upwardly mobile. Well, he says, it's pointless being upwardly mobile. The further up the ladder you get, in fact, the more torment there is. The less sleep you're going to have, the more worries you're going to have. You may have lots of possessions, but in the end, as we observed last week, you can't take it with you. This is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. He came naked, he'll go naked. So what's the point? What's the point? There's no point trying to make your life any better than it is. And so he concludes in verses 18 through 20. And he says, "Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labour in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labour, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart." What's he saying here? Well, his conclusion is the same as last week. Make the best of what you've got. Try and be satisfied with what you've got. You can't make your lot any better. This has come from God. What God has made crooked, you can't make straight. What God has given you, you can't change. So just accept it, do the best that you can, eat and drink and enjoy what good you can out of your labour. That's it, that's all there is to life. And if by any chance God happens to have blessed you with riches and wealth, if by any chance you have power to eat it, you can have these riches and they're not a burden to you, they're not causing you stress and concern, if you have that, what a wonderful gift that is from God. You know, you've really been blessed. Why have you really been blessed? Well, because you're not going to be troubled about your life. You won't dwell unduly on the days of your life. God is keeping you busy with joy, with pleasure. You're really blessed, you know. Something that he mentioned last time as well that I didn't look into in any depth in verse 26 of chapter 2. God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight, but to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting. Now the translation sinner there doesn't necessarily mean sinner in the sense that we have it. The Hebrew word is not so definite as that. Basically what the word is saying, God gives good things to some, he gives bad things to others. Some have the lot of receiving, others have the lot of giving to those who will receive. That's our life. Meaningless. It's all in God's hands. And we don't know what his design is. We have no deciding say in this whole thing. We can't influence God. You've just got to take it and make the most of what you have. Just put up with it. And be thankful if you are one of the rare few people in this world who has plenty and is able to enjoy it without any worry. Well, if you land on your feet, it's okay, is what he's saying. And if you don't, well, tough. But is that the way that we're to look at our lives? Our lives that are full of injustice and oppression. Our lives where we struggle to get a balance between striving but not striving from wrong motivation. Living in a world where God certainly is sovereign. How do we view life? How are we supposed to respond to all of this? Well, again, we've got to respond from an eternal perspective rather than an earthbound one. To recognise that this life isn't the ultimate reality. This life will end. It will be over. It will all be gone. But there is another life. And we need to use this life to prepare for the next life. And only in that can we find ultimate meaning in this life. Ultimate fulfillment. And it doesn't matter where you are on that ladder, whether you're reaching the top or whether you're just right down at the bottom, oppressed, unjustly used, trampled on by others who are running up the ladder. Wherever you are, you can use your life to prepare for the next life. You can approach God in humility, seeking his forgiveness for your sins, with a desire to use your life as an example to others of trust in God and hope for the future rather than despair and just, well, eating, drinking and being merry because one day you're going to die. You have a hope.
You have a vision for the future. You have an assurance that God has put in your heart that you are His child. You needn't live a futile life here. You can have one that is fulfilled. Fulfilled through a knowledge of God's blessing upon you and a desire to serve Him here and prepare to be with Him after death. So life isn't vain. Life isn't futile. Life isn't meaningless.